This is episode 200 right
now. Oh, it's your anniversary. It's a nice big round number.
It is a nice big round number, man. And this is good because, anyway, welcome to This Is Your Afterlife. This is
the
podcast. My name's Dave Marr. I was in a coma for a month a long time ago. Forget about it. Don't worry about it. But I've made one-man shows. I'm sure you're familiar with the sort of Edinburgh Fringe Festival industry, sort of.
I saw a Baby Reindeer.
Okay.
What is it?
Yeah.
That's what it's called.
Yeah. Did you see? Oh, you saw I saw the play.
It was a play?
Yeah,
I didn't know it was a play.
It was in a, first of all, it was in the big like drama part of the festival. So it wasn't
had drama.
Yeah. Oh, dude. Yeah.
I thought it was all comedy. I've never been. I've known people who have done shows there, but I've never been.
No, the impressive like bite-sized fact about it, when I last checked, it was the third largest ticketed event in the world.
I believe that.
After the World Cup and I think the Olympics. Yeah, it's like that big. So it's like there's music, there's comedy, there's circus is the like pretty cool thing to see there.
Now I'm starting to feel really personally attacked that I've never been invited. I thought it was just comedy, so it made sense that I wasn't necessarily invited, even though I could have been invited for that. But like there's music and nobody wants me there. All these are, well, that's not fun.
It's the industry in miniature where you got to invite yourself, kind of. You got to like put it all together, you know?
I mean, look, I'm sure not everybody there has invited themselves.
Okay. Fair enough. Yes, fair enough. Yeah. But there's a drama section, and it was in like a weird little, the show was in the round, and that woman's voicemails were, presumably he was playing her real voicemails.
That seems a little.
And they were projected all around the inside of the theater. So it's like these words like being spelled out, you know, like not karaoke, but like that level of like onslaught with text as he's sort of going with it. So that's what I thought you meant when you said you saw Baby Reindeer.
Oh, no, yeah, I saw the Netflix show, which made me deeply uncomfortable. And it sounds like this play would have also made me deeply uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. It's, yeah. But we'll get to that. I have the deep discomfort reminds me of something I wanted to ask you about.
Okay.
But before we do, so this is episode 200. Support the show on Patreon. The link's in the description. But you are like a perfect episode 200 guest because I went to Edinburgh twice. And the second time I went, I veered away from like the first year was like a storytelling-y Birbiglia, Birbiglia sort of show. Second year was weirder. There were like performance art pieces, dance pieces, and I can't even really describe without taking way too much time the bit I did, but it involved me playing a pigeon, trying to communicate with another pigeon, and then also somehow it was about the afterlife and about the limits of words.
Who played the other pigeon?
No one. It was you're seeing
one person. Yeah.
Yeah. You're seeing my journey of like attempting to get this other pigeon's attention. I'm communicating that the other pigeon has died at a certain point.
Without words. Just a sad pigeon man.
Yeah, sad pigeon man. That should have been the fucking title of the show.
It's not too late. You can, whenever you put it back up.
I would have to put it back up. It was called Feed Wolf Ice Cream. Now it's, this podcast is where some of these questions came from. But the soundtrack to that bit was one open mic Eagles Relatable.
Whoa, that's amazing.
Yeah.
When I wrote that song, I wasn't thinking that there would be a sad pigeon man performance to it.
Yeah, it's not something that would like be at the top of your mind for sure.
No. But that's a great surprise, I would say.
It's, I just, that EP, man, I really love that EP. And that,
thank you.
That song gives me, it gives me, like I feel like that bit is about to start when I hear, because it's got that little synthy intro.
Yeah, that little feels there. Yeah. It tickles you on the way in. You know something I realized about that song years later? And now I tell people this every time I perform it now. That
you still perform, it's still like an active part of
the set. It's made its way back into the rotation as of 2025. Like I perform it almost at every show now after not performing it for a while. But I sort of realize, and this is why I tell people this, because I feel like it sort of unlocks it in a different way, is that the song is about not feeling relatable at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to, or struggling to find ways to connect to people in like small talk environments and that sort of thing. But if you don't know that, and you just hear me saying how relatable I am for the entire song, that's sort of confusing, you know? But now, yeah. I sort of clear that up before I perform it so people know where it's coming from. And then we all have a better time. We all have a better time when I perform it after
really?
I say that.
Really? It feels so obvious.
Oh, gosh. You'd be surprised. And also, but also, you know, I don't always perform in circumstances where there are people attuned to my frequency. I do a lot of opening for bigger bands and stuff. Like, you know, and sometimes I just got to make it clear where I'm coming from, because people will take me at face value in a way that is not good for what I'm trying to do.
I mean, I just think it's that interpretation is so funny, like of the history of rap braggadocio to be the thing you're bragging about to be how relatable you are is a pretty good twist on that.
True, but it's just enough of a play on that trope that people will give themselves permission to take it sincerely.
Yeah.
If I don't tell them not to.
Oh, man. Well, I get it here. Here, you're safe.
Yeah, that feels nice.
The irony is you must have people telling you how relatable the feeling of not relating to things is.
Which is probably my intention in writing it. So that lines up.
Yeah.
You know, to like want to resonate with people who also feel that way.
Yes.
Like Sad Pigeon Man, for example.
Sad Pigeon Man, less relatable, you know?
Right. But wishing that he was.
I think so. I think ultimately, yes.
Yeah. Wanting to connect, you know?
Yeah, well, definitely, in this case,
the other pigeon.
That's
right.
I appreciate you not being like completely put off by this. Like, it's an abstract bit. It's an abstract compliment for sure. So I appreciate
it. I take it as such.
Yeah.
It certainly feels like a privilege to have been the music for that, you know?
Oh, definitely. Well, I mean, it felt right.
That's good.
You also have made it into the, like, my domestic vernacular where, you know, you have like little things from shows and songs and whatever that you and whoever else is in the house say all the time. And the thing that my partner and I will, it'll just come out randomly at times, is like, not mean, but like, what is it? And it is a very useful.
That's a good one.
It's a useful little phrase, man. Right. Yeah.
But what is
it? Okay. Yeah. No. Yeah. But what is it?
That's. Oh, I'm glad to hear that too. I'm proud of that little nugget.
Speaking of the Edinburgh stuff, are you familiar with, his name is Stuart Goldsmith, that Comedian's Comedian podcast? You never listened to that one?
Okay. I've not heard about it.
Cool. I used to listen to it a while ago. There's a Forbes article from 2016 talking to you about money stuff.
Oh, gosh.
And you said something that I very much related to, which was that you'd love to be able to afford all of your ideas.
Oh, God, that's the story of my creative life.
Yeah. Well, and you talked about, I assume, like critically being lumped in with other artists and people are like comparing your work and you're like, yeah, I'm the guy who spent, you know, single digit thousands of dollars on this. Mm-hmm. Can that be taken into account, basically?
I do think that's a little, I think that's a little better now. I think I have to think about that. It feels like there's a little more consideration given to that now. Not 100% sure, but it feels that way.
Okay, because I was curious if you feel more able to afford your ideas now.
Oh God, no, no.
Okay,
my ideas only get bigger, and my budget doesn't get bigger.
It does. Sometimes not, it not, would. I would think. yeah, fair enough.
Well, I put out my music through my own mm-hmm. record label, so my budget tends to be as big as how much money I made the year prior. So it can vary a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would the kinds of things, because the reason I relate it to this podcast is he's talking to some Edinburgh artist, and her way of describing how she wrote shows was like to first think about the no expense spared version of the show. If mm-hmm. there's a bit with Elton John, do you hire Elton John to come sing Rocket Man at the show?
Right.
And then you mentally, you go, okay, what's the like $1,000 version of this show? And you go, okay, maybe I hire an Elton John impersonator to come do this thing. And then you go, okay, what's the like zero, no budget version of this show? Maybe I print out a mask of Elton John and I'm singing through. And that was like, that like unlocked something for me to like think through like how to kind of DIY, reverse engineer DIY things. And I'm wondering what's like, what are the Elton Johns in the work you're doing that you wish you had the money to spend for?
I just like, I would, instead of really like making music videos or making like vertical videos like TikTok, Instagram, like any of the stuff that I have to make to promote my music when it's out, I would just make short films for everything. I would make a short film for everything, but like a really, really nicely done with a great DP, a crew, and an editor. I would write and probably direct it all, but like that is the level of media that I'd like to be employing to get across the themes of my music. And I can't afford to do shit like that.
So it's not even like playing, it's not even like treating the music video like a short film, so to speak.
No,
it's like
to be actual short film. And you know, it could potentially, it could break out into song in the middle of the short film.
Yeah.
But it would be a short film.
It sounds New Negroes-esque-ish,
yeah,
right?
I mean, kind of. But like that, it's funny. The process of that was that we had to make the songs before we even started production on the show.
Oh, wow.
Because we wanted each song to fit in with the theme of the episode. We basically had to come up with the themes, do the songs first. Because then we had to source guests for every, like it was a lot. Midway through production, Comedy Central was like, hey, you know these music videos you're going to do? We want them all to have like intro and outro skits. So we had to like write those while we were in production.
Okay. Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
So, you know, luckily most of them came out kind of feeling like they were coherent short films, but they were all sort of reverse engineered from a music video to like writing a skit around it.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's difficult.
It's some bullshit.
Yeah.
It was some typical television bullshit.
Well, it's one of those things that sounds like it could be like, and that was the restriction that really unlocked us and allowed our creativity to come out and play. And but then there's also the flip side, which is that it was bullshit.
Yeah, it was some dumb notes. Like that show was so frustrating because very quickly after Comedy Central bought it, it became very clear to us that they didn't want it, which was an interesting position to be in.
Yeah.
And so they started trying to fuck with it like from day one, you know? So like they bought a show where it was three comics and a music video. And then immediately they were like, can we get rid of the music video? And then ultimately they wanted the music video to be even longer.
Right.
So we had to cut everybody's standard. Like it was fucking ridiculous.
Why didn't they just kill it? Like from their perspective, why even like take it to air? Was it
Oh, because there was a bidding war for it.
Okay.
And they won the bid by giving us what's called a pay or play deal. Do you know what that is?
No.
They bought eight episodes. They bought a season straight up. Pilot plus seven.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the pay or play part meant that if they at some point decided they didn't want to air the show, they still had to completely pay for the production. They had to pay everything out.
Okay. Okay.
So it incentivized airing it. But again, nobody made them give us that offer.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the thing that they ultimately didn't want to do.
Yeah.
We could have went to the people who were bidding against it and that would have liked us and maybe gave us room to do what the fuck we wanted to do.
Do you think, you know, that would have been, or is that like grass is always greener sort of thing?
I think when we look back and we were able to even think about this while we were in production, we were like, oh, we maybe should have went over there just because the over there at the time represented a place where it wasn't the strict strictures of 30 minutes broadcast cable, which literally translated to 20.5 minutes with 8.5 minutes worth of commercials. And you take the opening credits out of that, like we had like 19 minutes. And that simply wasn't enough. And what ultimately was a giant factor as well was how Comedy Central's revenue worked at that time. Like they were not at all concerned with any sort of digital representation of the show or streaming representation of the show because their money strictly came from how much they could charge advertisers for the time that it was on the air in that particular time.
Right.
So that was all they were concerned with and weren't even really open to options for people to be able to find the show other ways at that time. They didn't have Paramount Plus then or nothing. So it was just like they had ComedyCentral.com that you had to use your cable login for.
Yeah.
But
I remember trying to see Roy Wood specials and then and just being like, when is this going to be fucking streamable?
Yeah.
And it's like, no. Yeah, you have to have your Comedy Central login.
They were not only late on that, they intentionally were like not about that because that was not how their revenue worked.
Well, listen, this is not the sort of trauma I'm trying to get you to relive. So I'm happy to,
but, you know, it's just right there at the surface. Sorry to say.
No,
just right
man.
There.
I appreciate it. But the discomfort thing, when you talked about deep discomfort before, we're going to get to the death questions. But I do, as I was like, the nice thing about doing research is you get to just like live in someone's world for a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that's been my past week. It's just like, you know, patching holes in the discography and watching interviews and stuff. And it comes up a lot that you're like, that you will say that you like to avoid discomfort, that you like prefer not to feel your feelings. And I'm not sure I believe you because to even say that is a level of like emotional intelligence that, because I relate to it too, where I'm like, realize how not in my body I am sometimes. Right. And I'm like, my value is to be an embodied human being who is present. But a lot of times I want to escape.
Right.
And, but there is a level of like feeling your feelings to even know what you're hiding from. Right.
Yes. So I am a very intense compartmentalizer. But I've learned that it is less about me not wanting to feel my feelings as much as it is me not being able to feel my feelings because they are compartmentalized in a part of me that I don't have as much access to. But that's something that I'm always working to open up.
Maybe that's the thing, is I can tell you're working to open it up.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's
always
like,
working open. Like, I wasn't comfortable in not feeling my, actually for a while I was before I realized the damage that was doing to me and anyone involved with me.
Yeah.
And since, you know, therapy's helped me come around to that I've been actively working on correcting, my pathways and blockages.
Yeah. That's a nice, way of it's, it really feels like a doctor in that way. Like you're describing it in such a like cardiac sort of way. Yeah.
That's how it feels. That's how it feels.
Yeah. Okay. So now I want to jump in and ask you what you hope happens when you die.
I don't have a hope.
Not at all.
Well, okay. You know what? My hope is that it's not like traditional basic heaven. I hope it's not that. I hope that I am not as a disembodied consciousness. I do not still recognize myself as an individual. I hope that it's not like that. Okay. And I don't think it is.
Sure. But what you think and what you hope, these are very different.
Right. But I just I would hate to be wrong about that. I would hate it if it was like regular Christian heaven.
Yeah.
I was like, fuck, I completely fucked this up.
Why? Yeah. What would you have fucked up if you find that out?
Being pretty not Christian would seem to be a huge, you know, missed opportunity on earth if that's what awaits me in the afterlife. Yeah. Is St. Peter with the book and such.
Assuming there's not a disciplinary structure like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to like see my grandmother, you know? Like, I don't necessarily want that. Like, cause like we're dead. So seeing her and doing what? What is the goal here? And it's this eternity? So I'm going to get sick of my own grandma after a while? Like I don't think when people have, you know, told these stories or imagined what it would be like, I don't think they've thought it through, you know? And I think that as long as we're individuals, this would not be a good time, ultimately. It wouldn't be a good time.
Because of... Is boredom the main limitation there?
It would seem to be a pretty big challenge. Since we're talking about like the hereafter, like that seems to be a time without end.
But if you were a being who, let's say that there's like a type of human that only lives for a year, and they find out that they get to live as long as you're currently living, they could think that would be boring, right?
Yes, they could.
Has your life been boring? I mean, have you had long stretches of like, not counting depression, but like my life is boring?
I'm never bored. But look,
right.
I'm going to die one day, which means I do a bunch of shit every day to try to have it done before I die. Mm-hmm. If I'm already dead, why am I doing anything?
It's because you want to grow. You want to get better. You want to like
develop. Do you develop. Grow after death? Do you develop?
Why couldn't
that would happen? Because I don't understand how that would work. Just like, okay. So there's like a library and a gym. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, what are we doing? We doing calisthenics or like,
no, like, I mean, but like, what is it is what you're having right now?
You say, what is it?
You're having a, not mean, but like, what is it?
Oh, but like, is yeah, it? Yes, exactly. Yes,
yeah.
That is exactly.
I mean, I know what you're saying. I guess that's the, because, you know, I'm curious to hear why you're okay or don't want specifically like individuation, because the thing that freaks me out personally is no longer being an individual, is not even having awareness.
It.
Why? But you wouldn't even, well, no, sorry, you're answering this question. Why would you love it?
Because I don't need senses if I'm dead. I don't need them. I don't need to see, hear, feel, nothing. Because I don't have a body. So why the fuck do I need to be an individual consciousness separated from any other consciousness? I don't know the purpose after my body's left behind.
Yeah. Okay. So this is assuming that you couldn't have a sort of consciousness that could experience senses in some other way.
In some weird way where you don't got ears, but you hear stuff. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like that sort of thing. I don't understand how that works. I don't get it. And I don't see the point.
I need
happy guess. 200.
Oh, people have done their worst to ruin the show, so don't worry.
That is not my intention.
Oh, not at all. I need people who are able to be as worked up as you're getting right now. You're honestly kind of like. This is not a thought that I've had before, so I appreciate it because what is it? I guess you're taking for granted that, like, before I think of anything else, the thing is that my senses are done. So given that, what do I want? And that seems to be what you're proceeding from. Is that right?
Yeah, like what is experience after you don't have a body?
Yeah. It's a hard question to like wrap your head around.
So it to me seems very likely that experience ends because you don't have a way to engage with anything physically.
Okay. Then does losing your body freak you out?
In as much as I'm trying to keep it now. You know?
Yeah.
But if I've lost that fight, it's over. I feel like.
Yeah.
Like that is the you know, the fear of mortality. I think it's literally like, yeah, losing my attachment to the mortal coil. I don't know what that means really, but I'm assuming it's got something to do with having electricity in your body or something.
Yeah, I think coil was probably like an old-timey word for earth or something like that, you know?
Yeah, something.
Yeah. So the fucked up thing is there's times when it's like, I need the show to stop for like 3 weeks so I can think about something, you know what I'm saying? I'm like, I'm going to have an idea about this, but
not immediately.
Immediately. No,
I can dig it. I live that moment so often where I'm like, 20 minutes after an interview ends, fuck, I got the perfect answer to that question.
Yeah. Okay, this is a good moment to transition to the question I have for you, which is what's your coma, which can be a moment as seemingly insignificant as that interview where before you're one version of yourself, after you're another. You might have just given me one. This whole like senses thing might be fucking my head up for a while, you know, maybe changes. 300 might be a very different show, and it also doesn't have to be like I went through a coma. That was wild. You know, the bigger thing than my coma was getting sober. So that actually is kind of more important than the coma, you know, it can be very minor though. Does not have to be a seemingly life-changing thing. I can tell you already know what I'm talking about, so I'm just gonna let you answer.
I think
the question.
So. I think for me, it's unsurprisingly, it would be therapy, and specifically when me and my therapist sort of stumbled on a thing called internal family systems.
Okay, yes,
that shit unlocked my understanding of myself to some degree instantly when like I was able to or encouraged to analyze myself in segments intentionally and be able to name the different parts.
Yeah. Can you give me the rundown? Because I've heard friends refer to internal family systems. A lot of like, it seems to relate to like adult children of alcoholics seem to deal with some of it. But yeah, what's your like breakdown?
I mean, like, well, for someone who doesn't get it, like I get it, you know what I'm saying? But, like, for someone who doesn't,
for you know, but for me, the way that it works is that, I consider all of the parts of my psyche as like people sitting around a table, you know, it's almost like a Herman's head inside out type of thing, or you know, like, but way more granular, way more curious. You know, this table, I think I originally thought of it as having like 6 or 8 seats. It might be like 20, you know, as I discover more things about myself. There's people, there's like components of me that don't even sit at the table. Like it's just like a sort of way for me to map my internal universe in a way that sort of honors the compartmentalization that I've done for survival in life. And the point of it being, I'm working towards an integration and actually being able to feel as if I'm one person that doesn't have to compartmentalize, and I'm my present self as much as I can be fully in all instances. But in the meantime, it's about identifying specific aspects of me that exist in a legitimate way inside of my mind.
Do they each have? Do they have names? Do they have?
They don't have like a name, like a like Charles or Bob or nothing like that. But it's more like the aspect of me that is afraid of a particular thing. The aspect of me that manages all the other aspects, like. There's an aspect of me that plays music in my head damn near constantly. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's more about naming them by function and hyperlocal desire than it is like, you're Sally. You're Margaret. Yeah.
Cause I think I understood, I think just the word family tripped me up when I would hear friends describe it. So I thought of it as like, this is the part of me that's my mom. This is the part of me that's my dad.
And I think for some people it might be that,
yeah.
But that's not what it is for me.
Okay. So was the coma simply the realization of all these different parts, or was there something else to the way they interact?
It was being encouraged to try to look at myself that way. Was the coma.
Okay. And so what changed? Because
I'd never had that thought. Well, what changed for me was sort of like a transition from trying to will myself to be a person who is like X, Y, and Z, right?
Yeah.
To like, oh, I am a person with different desires, impulses that are sometimes contradictory inside of them. Oh, so now I can like start by accepting these parts of me that I don't necessarily that seem to be less desirable at times, or produce feelings that are less desirable at times, where I used to sort of try to will them away.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can sit with them, acknowledge their realness, acknowledge whatever circumstances might have led to their existence, and sort to try to understand why it is I want this thing.
Well, so does that change? The thing I'm imagining is it changing. When I think about trying to be a person who XYZ, a lot of it is like me comparing myself to people I'm jealous of, or,
sure.
Why have I not achieved X goal? Why have I not achieved X goal that like people in my field all mm-hmm. seem to want this thing? And I guess what you're describing, it sounds like I would have to change the goal to like realizing that there's these other parts of you would make you like, yeah. I'll never be on SNL, right? Mm-hmm. I have plenty of friends who have been. And would I, what the fuck, I didn't mean that to sound weird in some way.
They didn't sound weird at all to
okay,
me.
Okay.
Now, if we're talking about professional jealousy, we can really talk. Like I'd struggle
sure.
with that.
Oh, for I, sure. For yeah. sure. But so for me realizing, okay, if the goal is I want to be on SNL, but I'm not getting there. I'm not being the kind of person who hangs out at Second City all the time to get on a Second City main stage. I'm not hounding whoever at the Laugh Factory or whatever the venues are that are having those showcases. Is it a matter of, oh, I listen to myself. Why am I, what's blocking me? And then I get past it and I become the person who wants to or gets on SNL? Or is it realizing that there's some part of me that actually wants something completely different and changing the path?
I think it's more the latter. Okay. It's more like when I had professional jealousy, what I used to try to do was just will it away. Don't think that. Mm-hmm. Don't feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that never fucking worked. But having the thought of, okay, I have this feeling. What part of me feels that way? The part of me that feels like it's some zero-sum game where if that guy gets a thing, then I can't have it. And that means that I'm less valuable or my work is less valuable. And just investigating that, you know, and like trying to understand, because that part of me, there's no particular achievement that would satisfy it.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like trying to understand what void or what lack or what thing that happened to me is sort of like creating this infinite need and just trying to like sit with it and understand it, you know? And sometimes it's about like, oh, if I'm trying to think of an example. Sometimes you can think about it and find a particular set of experiences that like sort of led you to this feeling of less worthiness, you know, or finite resources in a place where they don't really exist. And sometimes you can find the key to unlock it. And sometimes it's just about becoming comfortable with this feeling that might always be there, you know?
Yeah. And the, but so
it's
then
just,
the
it's
difference,
just a different way of being curious about it rather than trying to will it away, basically.
Well, right. And the difference between that and willing it away, because it's going to be there in both instances, is just your orientation to it.
Yes. And what feels to me to be like an actual way to process it rather than just feeling it and having a reaction.
So what does processing it look like? Is it a certain time you cried? Is it an experience of lightness that happens over a period of weeks and realizing you're not thinking of it? Like, what concretely does processing mean?
To me, I get a lot of juice out of the sheer acknowledgement of it.
Okay.
I feel a lot better in my body when I take those moments of just accepting that part of me feels a way and not judging it as something that shouldn't exist.
Yeah.
Like that, just that little bit of opening the door for like self-acceptance and loving, like I can feel a difference in even how whatever stimulus led me to have that bad feeling. I can take in that feeling differently if I'm okay with myself and even the things inside of myself that I don't think are the most stellar character traits, you know?
Yeah.
But if I can just accept that they are there, like I get a lot out of that initial thing.
Do you have the experience of describing things like this, those less than desirable character traits to people? Where, like, I'll have the experience sometimes where I will try to explain to someone that, like, I used to think this, or this one part of me feels this way. But then I'll try to describe that, like, oh, that's a thing I no longer think, or that's a thing that I would rather not feel or work through in some way. And I'll end up getting, like, advice from them on how to deal with the thing that is not even an issue for me in this exact moment. Does that happen to you?
I do think I've had that experience. I don't know if I have it often, but I do feel like I've had that experience.
I think I'm trying to figure out if there's like a thing about me that like appears like needy that people feel they need to solve in some way.
I'll say this. What it's making me think about is conversations where in real time I can tell that my intentions for laying a thing out aren't being understood,
mm-hmm,
you know, because mm-hmm. What a lot of people tend to do is just respond to the first thing they can understand.
Yes, and that's
before they take in the full intentionality of whatever it is you might be trying to lay out.
Yeah, and I had the experience of like, it's been recently, I would say maybe in the past 10 years. I don't know if it's a getting older thing. I don't know if it's a whatever, coma, sobriety, whatever thing. But like, I feel less eloquent in some ways. And it is like, I'll be aware of all the thoughts I want to say next. And you literally have to, this is why I'm bad at Twitter, is I will get, or I'm bad at what the classic Twitter like used to be, you know, where it's like joke economy, precision, blah, blah, blah. Because I want to include every way to say it, not just the like what seems like the funniest way to say it.
You're trying to do it, the quantum language. You want all possible possibilities of it. That's rough.
Right. You can always riff the big brain meme for everything. Yeah.
But you can riff. You could do the thread of tweets that all say the same thing different ways, you know?
Yeah, but that seems like an admission that
as defeat.
That yeah, you're like, you're, I don't know, in some way.
I can understand that, but it sounds like your initial goal is very lofty in trying to.
It's like, impossible.
Yeah.
It just is not possible. But so you saying people respond to the first thing they hear.
Well, not the first thing they hear,
but they can understand. Yes, of course. But sometimes that will be the first thing, you know. So you're like, you realize you've got to the end of the sentence and you fucking lost them or whatever.
Yeah. Well, right. Because what they're responding to, like, and basically people don't listen.
Yeah.
And what a lot of people do is as they're taking in information from you, they're running it through their own nervous system. And in trying to understand it, they're relating it to experiences that they've had.
Mm-hmm.
So what people will often do is just like, oh, the first thing that you say that they understand, they will tell you about their experience with that thing. Whether that's what you're asking for or not. Mm-hmm. Like that is sort of like a conversational shorthand. I do it. I feel like I do that sometimes. Sometimes that can be helpful for people to hear. Sometimes it's completely useless.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's, you know, those are the things that sort of happen in this gulf between two people trying to connect with intention, but not necessarily, they just don't know each other well enough yet, is what it sounds like.
Yeah. This is the level of trying to become better. Awareness of feelings, emotional intelligence, if that can be applied here, that I was talking about. Does this coma, does this experience of going through this therapy, it feels like a little bit of unlocking the matrix and things may have like slowed down. Does that make you impatient with other people where it's like, just please go to fucking therapy, like figure this out?
You know what? I wouldn't have said it before you put it that way, but I think that's true. I think there are sets of behaviors that people exhibit that I have very little patience for. And that's I think you've keyed into why I have that reaction. It's because to me they feel like very basic, sort of like the basic strides one would make to try to understand themselves and their feelings and where they are. Like when I feel like people haven't done that, I find it incredibly annoying. But I suppose that's only if I'm in a position where their lack of depth in that context can affect my life somehow.
Yeah.
Which isn't often. But
if you take everything personally, it can, you can choose to let it affect your life.
Yeah, but I don't take everything personally.
Yeah.
In fact, I am very good at not taking most things personally.
Okay. Yeah. Do you see this happening artistically? Because the thing that as you're describing being impatient with certain behaviors and people, for me, I relate it to stand up and like seeing people the most generic, basic version of this is like, you wore the dumb outfit. I don't have a lot of patience for you going on stage and being like, what am I, a fucking Tommy Bahama up here? It's like, dude, you chose the shirt. What the fuck is happening, you know? But the worst version is stand-ups acting like dirtbags, being like, well, you know, my mattress is on the floor, so blah, blah. And I'm like, dude, you can just like get a box spring. Like, do something to make your life better. It's like not funny to me that you're like trying to be like Hunter S. Thompson or some shit like that. You know what I mean?
I do.
Are there artistic versions of that that you have impatience for?
Not really. And this is the reason why. Like, and I suppose in my, you know, deep middle age, I've had to sort of understand this slowly. Like, when I think of artistic journeys in that way, my mind goes to rap music, right?
Yeah.
And I'm going to rap a particular way that's one, it's based on my, you know, my aesthetic tastes or whatever, my artistic values or whatever. But it's also informed by the sheer amount of rap music I've heard in my life,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I started listening to rap music 30 years ago, so it's been a whole fucking lot. But I can't expect, like, when my son plays me some 20-year-old guy rapping, you know what I'm saying? I can't expect that same level of experience from him. So I got to take that out of how I'm evaluating it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it's important for me to know for myself and to be able to explain to other people that, like, these things influence my processes, so this sort of informs my choices, but it's important for me not to project that onto other people's choices artistically.
But it's so interesting, because when you, I'm realizing now, you say like, I don't take a lot of shit personally. That does contradict the sort of availability for professional jealousy that we're talking about.
Well, when I say I don't take a lot of shit personally, I mean like Twitter, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, there's a version of me that may even have existed previously where, like, especially Twitter like it is right now, I wouldn't be able, like, everything on it would piss me off. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But, like, I know better. I know half these people are robots. I know that this is a fucking cesspool politically in this thing. Like, I know people are incentivized to be trolls. I know that I live in a troll culture in a clout epoch. Like, I understand these things. You know what I'm saying? And having those understandings allows me to have distance from having an intense emotional reaction to, like, all of these different stimuli, right? But inside of, you know, indie rap, for instance, I'm taking a lot of shit personal within that sphere. You know what I'm saying? Because in that sphere, most of the information that I receive feels more directly related to me because I exist in this world in a way that many people who are aware of indie rap are also aware of, you know? So, like, I can see myself being missing from a list that somebody made who knows about me.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I can see the shape of that in a different way where it does feel more personal. Even if it's not, it feels that way, you know?
Totally. I think for me, it becomes an arrogance where I think I am, like, standing up for, like, the art form in some way, where I'm like, mediocrity offends me because you're making this thing worse. Like, my example is like crowd work, the way that like most crowd work works. I'm like, you, every time you do a show, you will never have this collection of people in this physical space ever again. And the thing you want to do is ask what they do for a living. Like, get the fuck out of here, dude. It's like, so like, you have a live moment. You could literally ask anything you want, you know, and like.
But let me ask you something,
please,
because I have a sense that your issue with that is related to a thing that I have an issue with when it comes to rap that I don't like. And it's, yes, the rap that I don't like doesn't check my boxes for rap that I feel like is valuable for my personal life, mm-hmm. much as I imagine the crowd work that you're talking about, you don't find personally funny, which is one aspect of mm-hmm. it. There's another aspect of it. This rap that I don't find valuable for my personal listening is also incredibly popular.
Yes.
And that can fucking bother me sometimes.
Yes, absolutely.
Because I want, for the sake of the art form, I want listeners to be smarter than that. Or listeners to have more of a refined palate than that.
Of course.
And they don't. So I get pissed, you know? Yeah. And I wonder with this crowd work thing, like, the fact that the industry has completely moved in that direction with comedy clips, yeah. I wonder how much of that informs how much it bothers you.
Well, when you talk about audiences not having the taste for that, like, or not being smart to the art in a specific way, my fucking contrarian ass is like, well, yeah, okay, well, but some of them are, you know? So now sure. I'm on the fucking flip side. And what it sure. makes me think of is another Edinburgh thing, because my big experience with Edinburgh that was so valued, especially that valuable that first year, was flyering for my show. My show was called Dave Marr Coma Show. This is the story of me in this coma, you know, and mm-hmm. these Facebook eulogies that everybody wrote. And I was also flyering for two friends' shows, both Irish guys. One guy was like a silly, goofy, absurd guy. And the other mm-hmm. guy's show was called The Best Boy in Ireland. And it was a rowdy, dirty, good time. Very, he's a great comedian. I like him, but you know, he's a almost he's like a smarter version of like a lad. You know,
I don't know,
like an Irish lad, you know, like okay. that sort of bro, UK bro culture, you know.
Gotcha.
And his show was the easiest show to flyer for. It's like, this is a funny comedy show. You're going to have a great time. And I realized I could technically get the same number of people into my show, but I would need to flyer probably 10 times more people to get the same numbers. So I don't know. Does that come, the taking it personally, the wanting people to be hipper to it, it's just so easy to get a chip on your shoulder for like, well, the thing I do is, you know, cutting edge, is blah, blah, blah. Like, I just wish I had the machinery. I wish I had the money for my ideas to reach 100,000 people instead of 10.
But wait, now, okay. I feel like going to the resource wish sort of skips over a very important.
Please, yeah.
A very important characteristic about being cutting edge, about doing something different, is that inherently it's less appealing. Like, just inherently.
Yeah.
Like, that's like, and I, you know, I just think a lot of people, I feel like I've come to terms with this a long time ago, but I feel like a lot of people who do something different need to understand that that's the choice they're making, you know?
Yeah.
Like, You're like, I'm the kind of person who thinks that's a more valuable thing to do, but just mathematically, most people don't.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like mathematically, most people want a sort of escapist entertainment that's not going to challenge them too much or make them too uncomfortable, so that we have to understand that when we're choosing to follow our own creative whims and make those things, we are reducing the amount of people that our work will appeal to, you know? I just think being honest with ourselves about that is a good idea. That and I find that sometimes I don't think people are honest about that.
Well, yeah, and I feel like the thing that people will talk to you a lot about is art rap, but the more relevant word in the title of that album is actually unapologetic for what you're talking about.
Wow. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Because I was doubling down on a choice and answering a question that nobody was asking.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that Like, and I did feel like that was important in setting people up for understanding who I am.
Yeah.
You know, but inherent in that is, you know, like the math is built into it. You know, mm-hmm. we're like, this will not be the number one thing on Billboard because nobody has ever asked for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've been like writing a description of something or a blurb and tried to find a version of that for comedy or performance art. Mm. That's like, because art comedy sounds so fucking whack, dude.
I understand. I mean, art rap is not the greatest phrase, so I understand. But yeah,
I don't
art
know. Comedy, maybe you just owned comedy. It enough that it sounds normal to me.
I mean, it's aged. It's become a little bit more regularly thrown around in the vernacular. But it's like it is now also pretentious in a way that makes it yes. unnecessary.
Yeah. Totally.
So I'm still looking for something else too, but you're right. Like art comedy sounds bad out the gate.
Yeah. Like, or like I'm thinking of like, you know, like post rock, like post comedy, yeah. you know, or, and it's just like,
well, so is yeah. alt comedy not good? I always felt like alt comedy was kind of good.
I guess that is the thing, but then that's me, you know, that fuck. I wish I talked to you like years ago. Because it is totally good. The only part of me that thinks it's not good is the part of me that actually needs like a specific word that only describes exactly what I do. You know what I mean? Which is like, get out of here, dude. Just fucking relax.
So it's just Dave comedy. You know, you just need to call it Dave comedy.
Yeah. Do you have time for one more question?
Sure.
Okay. The memory question. So this was a premise in the Feed Wolf Ice Cream show, the Sad Pigeon Man show.
Sad Pigeon Man.
This is a, yeah, you really, they might be giants. The,
that's exactly that, where I was coming from yeah. too.
It's, so the question I had for people was if there is an afterlife and let's presume that you get to fully relive one memory. It's not that the rest Ooh. Are wiped. It's just that you have to choose one to re-experience particularly vividly whenever you want.
I have such a hard time with that question. I saw that one in the email and I was like, that shit made my body feel weird. Thinking about that question.
Well, I'm glad it's not just you making me feel weird then.
Like, I, because there's something about the idea of reliving an experience and being fully aware that I'm reliving it that sounds fucking just so bizarre to me. Like, I feel like that's like, okay, because the easy way to handle that question psychologically is, you know, what would you go back and do differently, right? Like,
oh,
you
yeah, have but some no,
abstract knowledge. Yeah. Right. But no, this is like with a full mind of experience, like try to go back to some younger version of myself with my old man brain. And like just the thought of even being in my old body like that, it just feels so strange. And I don't know. Because of that strangeness, I don't know that there's a moment that I'd want to live in. I don't know that I'd be able to access anything good about it. I'd rather do something insane tomorrow than go back in time with my old man brain and even if it was last week. I'd be like, this is fucking weird.
What do you mean do something insane tomorrow?
Right, like something I wouldn't do, like jump out of a plane. Sure, like, sure, I'd rather sure. do that. I'd okay. rather do that.
Some sort
I'd
of rather peak take experience,
my,
yeah.
Yeah, some sort, like, just anything uncomfortable, like, with my current wiring where I could get something out of it. Like, you know, like the experience would help, would add to my experiences. Like, I would have the opportunity to gain something from it in my nervous system.
Right.
Where like, I can't understand the gain of anything in re-experiencing an old moment. Like I don't see the gain. Like even like, because you immediately think of good times, but then I also immediately think that wouldn't feel good to do again.
Sure. It's really, you're like really reaffirming your commitment to like the senses.
Yeah, that's all we got.
Yeah.
So we
well,
got.
Well, I'm not so sure. I'm not committed to that yet. But
I'm just saying, what we know of as senses, what they call epiphenomenon of having a nervous system, and these mechanisms, eyes, ears, skin, nerves to interact with the world. And what we know for sure is that when we're dead, we don't got the body box no more. We know that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It seems at the very least difficult to imagine the senses going forward from the body in any way.
Totally. I think there is another way. There is another thing that I'm trying to get from asking the memory question, mm-hmm. that I think I can rephrase, and I'm curious what your relationship to the rephrase is. Is a moment in which you were aware of how good it was. I've explained this on the show, but the question came about from me having the moment, which was a very weird. It wasn't like there was no one else there. I was driving to do a performance of the first one-man show in suburban Cincinnati. And I had made myself a turkey sandwich, and I had put salt and pepper in the sandwich, and it tasted really good. And I was listening to the song Floating by Schoolboy Q. And I was rapping along, you know, swag on match, bitch, I'm floating, you know, like with this mouthful of turkey sandwich. And it was so fun. And I was like, this is so dumb, but this is so fun. And like, there's other times when I've been like, you know, these are the good old days sort of sure. like moment. And that's, I guess, the question that I'm asking with the memory question.
I am I remember I took an acting class here in LA. This was shit. This was damn near 10 years ago now. And I remember like, It was a quote unquote intensive is what the class was yeah. called. And the way it was designed, like, you know, my class, my cohort, we had to meet like 3 times a week and act for like a month. So we went from being complete strangers to like this really tight unit very quickly. Like we felt like we were in a fucking foxhole together.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just old enough to know how quickly that feeling was going to fade away.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was just old enough to have and had enough experiences to understand, like, and I told him too, I'm like, this level of connectivity that we feel right now, if anybody's interested in holding on to this, we should, because it would take effort, because you will be surprised at how quickly we will go back into our lives and never speak again. And you know, we got together a few more times. Some of us stayed in touch. I can't tell you the last time I talked to any of them now. But like, I find myself being very aware of that sort of entropy.
Yep.
You know, mm-hmm. and like how you have these sands in your hand, you know, when you have them, and slowly but surely you're going to end up with empty hands, you know. So like, I don't know. I guess I have a lot of moments like that. Like a lot of moments where I'm like, yep, it won't be this. It won't be like this too much longer. You don't know when, you know, but like moments of like peak connectivity, peak, like, look at this thing we've done. Look at this thing we've made. Look, like we made the new Negroes, like at a rap party for a television show, mm-hmm. like that sort of energy. Like, and it's funny because it's part of the reason why they have rap parties is because like, you're in a foxhole together for like 3 months making this thing. You're seeing these people every day all working together on this goal. And there's literally people you love to death that you don't know if you're ever going to fucking see them again. And some of them you're not. The people you may have depended on the most, the people who might have brightened the shit out of your day, you know, it all changes almost by design, especially in Hollywood, because everybody goes off and works on separate shit, you know?
Does that keep you from enjoying it, though?
It doesn't keep me from enjoying it. I find it difficult, though.
Yeah.
I do find it difficult because I, when I find that sort of circumstance of people I love, I want to hold everybody together.
Yeah.
You know, like that is my instinct. My compulsion is to, you know, keep everyone together, but that's just not what people do, you know? Especially when it comes to professional shit. Like, personal shit is different, but professional shit, people go to separate ways.
Yeah. I had a moment re-listening to the Anime Trauma Divorce album today where I had never really listened. For whatever reason, it stuck out to me this time. Tell me if I'm reading this wrong, but your tone of voice, I felt like I could hear you smiling in 15, 20 feet ocean nah.
Oh, fuck yeah. Big smile.
That I was like, moment. God damn, like he's having so much fun watching his kid do this shit.
Oh, yeah. I'll send you that video sometime. It's amazing.
Oh, it'd be great. I would love to see it.
Yeah.
But that feels like almost the opposite of what you're of like not even needing to cling on to it. It just like being there, and obviously that's someone who's like very much still in your life, and you know,
right? Yeah. But you know, but kids do embody that difficulty in a way too, because yes, that moment was completely joyous for me, and it was joyous for my son in that moment. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't feel the same way about it now.
Yeah, yeah,
he's
yeah,
a teenager.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Right. So it's like he sort of embodies it just in himself. Like his relationship to that moment changed. Which is difficult for me because we can't have that moment now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's rough.
Well, thanks so much for doing the show, dude.
Excellent work, Dave. Excellent work.
That is all I've got. I'm very grateful for you doing episode 200.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and thanks for being patient, and I'm glad I got to be on this one.
Of course, man. What is the stuff you would like people to visit, the internet locations to access your work?
It's a great question. So the music is available, a lot of it on Bandcamp, so I would love for people to engage with that. Mm-hmm. Also on all the streaming services. Also stream on Twitch 3 times a week. I do a thing called The Morning Show on there. We invented The Morning Show. It's what we did.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And I put a lot of stuff up on YouTube, too. So just about every entertainment platform you put my name in, it, something will come up. So I encourage people to do so.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Thanks, folks, for listening. Thank you to Matt Sage for the show's art. And this is your Afterlife house band, Lake Mary, for the music. Visit patreon.com/thisisyourafterlife. Like I said, I don't run ads. This is the way to support the show. The show is weekly if you listen on Patreon. It's every other week this way, but I release bonus episodes on the off week. So make it a weekly show. Go to Patreon. Yeah. And until next time, remember, you are a mist.
Oh, that's great.
Cool. Thanks so much for doing this, man.